We are in 1 Chronicles 19. The last chapter had David possibly feeling somewhat invincible after being told that the throne of Israel would belong to his line forever, and that led him to cleaning up after Saul and to destroying the enemies of Israel. This chapter contains a story about a war that he did not pick, but how it turned out the best for Israel anyway. In the last chapter, he was on the offensive. This time, things change a little bit, and he didn't really want to pick a fight. He tried to do something nice. So who wants to read verses 1 and 2?
Then Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned safely to his house in Jerusalem. And Jehu...
Wait a minute.
Where are we at?
1 Chronicles 19.
I'm in 2 Chronicles. Go ahead. Somebody else.
It happened after this that Nahash, king of the people of Ammon, died, and his son reigned in his place. Then David said, I will show kindness to Hanun, the son of Nahash, because his father showed kindness to me. So David sent messengers to comfort him concerning his father. And David's servants came to Hanun in the land of the people of Ammon to comfort him.
All right, so to begin with, there is no passage in the Bible that directly says David had been shown kindness. Nowhere. Nowhere does it say that. We're not even sure exactly what that is about. We have some ideas, but nothing positive. Nahash was a known enemy of Saul. He did not like Saul. He was an enemy of Israel, but he particularly did not like Saul. And it is believed that he is one who offered aid to David when he was fleeing from Saul. That's what they think. He was one of the ones who was in that. He didn't do it out of kindness to David as much as he did it out of spite to Saul. We play the same game here in America. We support the people who want to turn over the leadership of a country. We are always messing in other people's politics. He was kind of doing the same thing back then. What is known, he had a son named Shobi. That was a son of Nahash. He did offer aid to David while he was fleeing Absalom. But that was his son who was trying to take over the throne. The reason they make these connections is they think that they met when he was fleeing Saul. Nahash, the dad, helped out. Now the son's helping out this time. He would be a half-brother to Hanun. And it is also believed that after Hanun loses, that the vassal king set up on the throne was actually Shobi, his half-brother. They became a vassal country to Israel, which we're going to get into. David, being a man after God's own heart, decided to send his condolences to Hanun. Even though they were not kin, no relation, nor did they share the same values. Did not follow the same God, didn't have the same laws, totally different people. But he was his neighbor. So David believed as a neighbor he should show kindness, and he reached out, and that's what happened. We should not dislike a person just because their belief system is different than us. We should show kindness. We should never stop us from loving someone or treating them right just because they are different than us. So somebody read verse 3.
I'll read it at 2.
Okay. Is this in 1st or 2nd Chronicles?
It's in 1st.
Okay, we'll do that one then.
And the prince of the people of Ammon said to Do you think that David really honors your father because he has sent comfort to you? Did his servants not come to you to search and to overthrow and to spy out the land?
So now think about that. Satan once again is using lying words of a deceiver to spread doubt. He always does that. Satan, if you ever notice, most temptations of Satan are not direct. They are always to make you question, make you wonder. He will cast doubt where none existed. None at all. That's his job. Once he gets you to doubt things, he weakens your faith. This time he used it against the king to doubt the motives of David. So when this first happened, he probably felt honored that David sent some people over to wish him condolences. David, you gotta remember, he was riding pretty high on victory after victory. Pretty powerful king, and this king honors you by sending some messengers with a word of condolence for you. But thanks to other leaders in his palace, he now has changed his mind. I think David might be spying, so his respect turned into suspicion. Somebody read verse 4.
Wherefore Hanun took David's servants and shaved them and cut off their garments in the midst hard by their buttocks and sent them away.
Now that's a really strange thing to do, but that was considered a major insult. To Jewish men, it was a terrible insult to have your beard shaved or your butt exposed. And he did it to both of them. He cut the seed out of their garments for them and sent them packing after shaving them. You know, the top knot. In a lot of the Asian countries, you defeat your enemy, you cut his top knot off his head. That's just, it's a shame. It doesn't hurt, it's just a shame. They didn't want to hurt these guys, but they did want to shame them. And imagine the big laugh they had when they sent those guys out of the city. Because you know they made a big spectacle of those guys. Look, we shaved our beard and you can see their butts. That's kind of a childish way to act, but that's probably exactly what they did. They acted pretty hastily and they have yet to realize what they really did. But verse 5. So David offered them what protection he could. He did not have any suspicion at all that they would have been treated rudely, because that's against the law of all nations forever. If you send somebody as an ambassador, they have certain rights and privileges and protections. The chance of somebody violating that, even in wartime, was so rare that it wasn't even considered. We still have those same rules today. So he wasn't able to protect them there, but he could kind of help them save face a little bit. He let them stay at Jericho before they came back to Jerusalem till their beards grew back out. Now, for some people like Sean, that was probably 3 days. For other people I've seen in this church, that could have been years. I don't know. But he did let, and I'm sure the little garment problem they fixed relatively quick. That was a simple fix. But in this respect, David was actually being a good leader. He was supporting those who followed him, and he was doing all he could for them, and he was trying to save them from further embarrassment. Let me see. 6 and 7.
When the people of Ammon saw that they had made themselves repulsive to David, Hanun and the people of Ammon sent 1,000 talents of silver to hire for themselves chariots and horsemen from Mesopotamia, from Syrian Makkah, and from Zobah. So they hired for themselves 32,000 chariots with the king of Makkah and his people, who came and encamped before Medeba. Also the people of Ammon gathered together from the city and came to battle.
Boy, now look at that. Now that's quite an army being put together. These people, when they realized they had made a mistake, in true human fashion, they poured fuel on the fire. Instead of apologizing and trying to explain the confusion or the misunderstanding that they had, they just doubled down. They just gonna go all out and say, well, obviously we're probably made him mad. That was kind of a rude thing to do. So let's just make sure we have more people than he has when it comes time to go to battle. So they buy some mercenaries is what they do. Verses 8 and 9. All right, so this is probably one of the passages in the Bible that actually inspired J.R.R. Tolkien in his Hobbit series. His whole story of Middle Earth was based on a Bible belief of good versus evil. He took a lot of imagery out of the Bible to make his battles look the way they did. This is probably one of them. I don't know that for sure, but I do know that is a fact that he used the Bible for inspiration as he told this story to his children. But can you imagine what that battlefield looked like just prior to the battle? Has anybody here ever been involved in war? Nobody's been on a battlefield? I've only played war games when I was in the Army. We didn't actually have enemies to shoot at, just other people. But there is a tenseness that goes on. When I was in the Army, they got us up in the middle of the night, made us get all of our gear, pack it all up, and go out and get on the cattle trucks, and they ran us to the airport. And they told us we were deploying. This is something they do to every class, I'm sure. Said that the Middle East had finally erupted, and they were calling everybody to go over and fight. So here's a whole bunch of green recruits who know nothing, and we're all standing around in the dark with everything we own strapped to us, including our M16s, thinking we're going into battle. So not quite the same thing, not even close to the same thing, but I understand kind of that nervousness that's going on, the uncertainty. I don't know what's going to happen in the next few hours or days or whatever. We're in the middle of something big, and we don't know how it's going to come out yet. So soldiers are normally pretty uneasy. They're restless. A lot of that tension that they're feeling and everything, it will go away as soon as the battle starts, because it's all the pressure of just anticipating the unknown is where the pressure comes from. Once it starts, you know what's going on. You rely on your training. Things get a little smoother. But I'm sure that these armies lined up against each other were pretty impressive. You can see all the people they brought. Israel brought a whole bunch of people. All the Ammonites came out to support all the mercenaries they hired. I mean, there's a lot of people on this battlefield. And it's pretty tense. But anyway, somebody read 10 and 11.
When Joab saw that the battle line was against him before and behind, he chose some of Israel's best and put them in battle array against the Syrians. And the rest of the people he put under the command of Abishai, his brother, and they set themselves in battle array against the people of Ammon.
All right, so this is another trait of a good leader. He did not back down when things looked grim. He made a plan. You know, and that's what leadership is about. You have to lead, not freeze. You have to do something. So he has a problem, though. His enemies in front of him, and they're also behind him. That's a major problem. He's facing two armies on opposite sides of the field he's standing in, and he needs to come up with a pretty good plan. He needs two armies. He doesn't have two armies, so he cuts his in half. Gives it to his brother. Now, you can claim nepotism, if you like, but these guys were raised the same. They went through the same training, and he knew that nobody would have his back better than his brother, and that their relationship would be strengthened in case of need. And that's what he wants. This battle formation they're in swiftly leads to defeat, because all everybody has to do is just crush you in the middle, and that's the end of it. So he said, look, you go over here and I'll go over there, and we'll fight. And we'll support each other if need be. Somebody read 12.
And he said, if the Syrians are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the people of Ammon are too strong for you, then I will help you.
All right, so what was the danger in his plan? Think of, there were several inherent dangers to his plan.
You still have to focus on the other person if they're in trouble or not.
True. I mean, yeah, so your attention's a little divided now. Your army's divided. You're not putting as many people on the front as you need to, because you have two fronts now. But think of the bigger problem he's facing. He split his force in half, so their chance of being overwhelmed is even greater than it was before. And you're counting on the other people, the other half, both halves are counting on the other half, to not only hold their ground and not run, but also to show up if need be. That's putting an awful lot of faith in people, I will tell you, because that doesn't always work out that way. I don't know. You know how it is. People say, I'm right behind you, and they may be, but they didn't clarify it was 10 miles behind you. You thought they were marching lockstep with you, and it turns out they never moved. They're just behind you. People don't really stand up very well. Terrible risk he took right here because of the division, weaker forces, people being scared, people running. It was not uncommon for people to flee a battlefield. It's still not uncommon for people to flee a battlefield, except it's a good way to get shot by your own people. But back then, I mean, the whole armies would leave battlefields. And we're going to look at that now. But he had a lot of trust in the people he led and a lot of trust in his brothers. So, 13.
We have good courage and let us behave ourselves diligently for our people and for the cities of our God, and let the Lord do that which is good in his sight.
So, that's pretty encouraging words. In all honesty, for good locker room talk, there you go. Their encouragement was only possible because they were actually fighting for the Lord. This was not a squabble over something minor. This was a much bigger piece of spiritual warfare going on. Satan was trying to destroy Israel. So every time Israel had to defend itself, if they were doing the right thing, God would help protect them. He knew they were in the right spot. They were God's chosen, and with the knowledge that God would stand up with them when they were right, gave them courage to go fight. We need to remember that the battle is the Lord's. It is not ours. We just need to do our part. We can't leave the battlefield. We have to stay there and play our part to the fullest. 14 and 15. All right, so this is another one of those battles where the preparations were much more impressive than the actual fight. There was no fight. Everybody got dressed up for war, and the other side went home. I personally wonder what really happened that scared them so bad. Because I can tell you, if I had a force that size and the enemy was stuck in the middle, retreating from that battlefield would not be my first thought. It might be the last thought once things went the wrong way. But it just says they ran. They just ran. If you remember, God has done this for Israel before. He has scared the enemy in such a way that the enemy believed they were outnumbered, the battle was going to be lost, and they ran. God has done that multiple times. I just didn't record what happened here. What'd you say?
It was psychological.
Yeah.
He split his army. He had such confidence.
He could have been.
He split his army, and the enemy goes, wait a second. Look what he's doing. He's not running. He's splitting his army. Of course they're going. They knew about Israel's successes.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of psychological part there. It's sometimes fights are won before they ever start by the psychological edge you can get. If y'all remember the movie Hooper with Burt Reynolds, and it had Terry Bradshaw in it. And they ended up getting in a disagreement in this bar, and Burt Reynolds stands up and goes, let me see. He said, there's 12 of you and 5 of us. You know what that means? Y'all better go back home and get some help. That's a pretty good line. Didn't matter. But if you're going to stand up 5 to 12, try to intimidate if you can. That's always a good thing. But, and it did it here. They were intimidated for some reason. I mean, besides the fact these guys came into the battle knowing Israel was victorious everywhere they were going. And you're right, to see him split his forces makes them wonder what that would be. But God will sway the enemy's minds through fear. Through fear. He will plant that little seed of doubt in their minds. Satan knows how powerful doubt is because God uses it also. 16.
Now when the Syrians saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they sent messengers and brought the Syrians who were beyond the river and the Shaphat, the commander of their army went before them.
Okay, so the Syrians believed they could have taken Israel. If only they had had more help. They just needed more people. It wasn't that they were afraid, they were just outnumbered, and they were going to come back and they were going to prove a point. This is that typical Monday morning quarterback. You see this a lot. You see where people, instead of taking their losses, they will want to regroup and come back and retaliate. This is that escalation thing that we worry about a lot in life. We worry about people escalating. So many things are to de-escalate today. We run around trying not to offend people for fear it will escalate into a fight. These guys, they said, you know what? We know better. We're better soldiers than them. We just need more people. They got more, and they go back. Somebody read 17.
When it was told David, he gathered all Israel, crossed over the Jordan, and came upon them, and set up in battle array against them. So when David had set up in battle array against the Syrians, they fought with him.
So this time they put up a fight, at least for a little while. I guess their national pride had been hurt because they had run without a battle. So now they're out to prove something, and they get there and they start fighting, and this time the battle turns against them fairly quickly. So it's time to run again, really, is what happens. 18.
But the Syrians fled before Israel, and David slew of the Syrians 7,000 men which fought in chariots and 40,000 footmen, and killed Shophach, the captain of the host.
So think about that. Their resolve to fight only lasted so long. It didn't last long at all, really. As soon as the battle turned in David's favor, they decided to run again. David and his men gained a resounding victory that day. And what sealed their victory for them? What was the final act that sealed their victory? They killed their commander. They killed the commanders. One thing to lose your flag is another thing to lose your military commander. The man who knows more about fighting a battle than anybody is the guy in charge usually. And they killed him. Now they don't even have anybody to put together a plan. They have to run. So what happens when you put your faith in man? Anyway, somebody read the last verse.
When the servants of Hadadezer saw that they were defeated by Israel, they made peace with David and became his servants. So the Syrians were not willing to help the people of Ammon anymore.
So why do you think they weren't willing to help the people of Ammon anymore?
They just got into a fight.
Yeah. Wasn't even their fight. The Syrians were just paid to show up. Wasn't even their fight. And what happened? They lost, and they lost big time. They actually became servants of Israel. So I'm sure if an Ammonite came into camp, they probably would have killed him, if not chased him off at least, maybe even killed him. Because they were just sitting over here minding their own business when the Ammonite said, hey, we can go conquer Israel with your all selves. Why don't you come in? And they thought it was a great idea, and it backfired on them. They no longer had the military might to launch an offensive. Their force had been somewhat decimated, but they had lost their commander. And they didn't even have the ability to help somebody else in their fight anymore. They couldn't even defend themselves. They became servants. So there is a lot in here we can learn. What's the first thing we can learn? Somebody give me something we can learn from this chapter.
true.
But I don't think any of us would do that. I mean, we're not big enough to pick a fight. But that is true. But what would you... Let's go back to David right at the beginning. What did he do right at the beginning of this chapter?
He went to thank them for the victory they had. Because they lost their father or something.
That's right. Yeah, he went to comfort him. Yeah, he was just being nice. We need to be nice to our enemies. That's the thing. God says, love your enemies. This was not an active enemy, but it was not a friend of Israel. These people were not a friend of Israel. The king who had died had been an active enemy of Israel in Saul's time. He just hadn't tried anything lately because he'd gotten old. Probably David might have had another reason for going to see him. What do you think that other reason might have been?
Because when David was running away from Saul, and he has a head from that.
That's right. But what was the other? Yeah, but he was going to repay a kindness. When's the best time to win the battle?
Time of peace.
Hmm? Before it starts.
Yeah.
Let's go win the battle before it starts. The old man got old and he wasn't fighting us anymore. His son's in charge now. Not the good son. The good son was Shobi. You got a different son in charge. We might want to go make friends with him. Just keep the peace. Just keep status quo. But regardless, David was a man after what? God's own heart. And he was doing what God expects us to do by reaching out, having compassion on our enemies. What's another thing you can learn? This one would be from the battle. Right. The fight belongs to the Lord. Our job is just to make sure we're on the Lord's side. Abraham Lincoln, he was asked a question. I can't remember what his exact answer, how the wording actually was, but they said, a reporter asked him, do you think God is on the north or the south side? And he said, I'm not so concerned that God is on my side as much as I'm concerned that I'm on his side. He said, I don't pray that God is on my side. I pray that I'm on God's side. That's the key to a battle. You got to be careful. Don't make a stand for something stupid. Everybody's heard the saying, you got to pick which hill to die on. There are certain things you just don't argue about. They're not worth dying. How many times have we let one of our children do something very minor and inconsequential because it's just not worth the argument it costs? Try to stop it. They want Jell-O at midnight. You probably shouldn't have Jell-O at midnight, but it's not the end of the world if you have Jell-O at midnight. I just wish you'd pick a different time. But I could say no, and we could argue a little bit. We could spend a lot of time escalating this into a punishment, but let's just not fight on this hill. But we got to be careful as Christians that we are not fighting a secular battle that has nothing to do with God. Because there's a chance God won't be on your side for that. He might be on the sidelines watching. But he's really not going to be actively involved in that battle because you're not fighting for him. All the stuff we think is so important may not really be that important to God. We got to make sure that we have that. What's something else that we can learn from people's behavior in this thing?
Don't be so prideful to not apologize before hiring so many men to battle for you.
Right. A soft word turns away wrath. And, you know, he could have went back and apologized, and it would have just solved the whole thing. His lack of apology cost two countries their freedom. The Ammonites became a vassal kingdom, and the Syrians became a servant kingdom. So those are two different kingdoms. One, in a vassal state, there's a puppet in charge who does everything the king from the winning nation says. So he's there, he's in charge, but he's only the face of the people in charge. He's not really in charge. He has a certain amount of freedom that he can move in, and that's it. He's not truly a reigning monarch. The other nation, they lost theirs altogether. They became servants. They existed for the sole purpose of serving Israel. So that all could have been avoided if they had just said, sorry, didn't happen. Pride definitely gets in the way. Anything else you all can think of they would learn from this?
This is the second time that Hadadezer failed, right?
Yes. Yep. Seems to me some folks never learn, right? Actually, they should have learned after the very first battle right here when they all ran. They should have said, okay, that was stupid. We got paid. Let's go home. We didn't give our money back. We kept our paychecks for showing up. But if the Ammonites hadn't lost, what do you think the Ammonites would have done to the Syrians? Who ran first in the battle? Who was the first side to run?
The Syrians.
The Syrians ran first. Why do you think they ran first?
Fear.
Yeah, but everybody was afraid. But what was the... Not their battle. They're just paid to be there. It's not their battle. They're not committed to this cause. they honestly don't care about this cause. They didn't pick the fight. They don't have anything to lose. We just got paid to show up. But when it looks like it's going to be too much, we quit. They're not committed to that. So they ran first. The Ammonites would have been pretty angry about that if they had survived. If they had continued as a free country, they would have probably went to war with the Syrians for abandoning them on the battlefield. But once they all ran, the Ammonites, now they had a bigger problem. Now they were afraid of half the army. Now they have the whole army back. Everybody's facing them. So they had to run. Not the best idea. They should have let well enough alone when it was over the first time. This pride thing keeps coming back into it. They keep wanting to prove a point. So for us in our daily lives, we just need to remember to treat our enemies with compassion. Treat those who are different than us with compassion. Think of what a difference we would have in America if we could learn that, just to treat people with compassion. But no, it all has to be a big blow up and everybody has to argue with everybody. It doesn't help. It escalates it. And that we need to make our stands when we know God is on our side. We need to make sure we are doing what God expects us to do. Let the fight belong to Him. We just do our part. Those are the biggest things. Don't let pride get in the way. None of that stuff. Just follow whatever God is asking you to do. Any questions? We're done a little early. Any questions?